Could you run down the sequence of events, logbook entries that you make as you prepare to turn the watch over Mr. Blanford, starting from 23:30?
Well, I didn't make any logbook entries. I just went back over all the logs to make sure that they were in order. When I say in order, when a vessel gets underway from the port, then you log the time it left, where it's going, its ETA to the next port, and you make sure that's done. And I have to do that on, I believe, three different pieces of paper, three different logs. I've put the time underway. So I went back to make sure that, that all that was in order, and that the logbook I've written down that I was on watch from 16 to 2400. I put down my name on watch. And I just made sure all that was in order.
What time did the Exxon Valdez call you regarding their course changes?
I don't really recall exactly what time it was. Comes to mind about 23:30. I believe it was just before Skip arrived.
During our earlier interview, you stated that when the Exxon Valdez said they were altering course to 200, that you walked over to the status board. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
What did you do?
I took the sticker of the Exxon Valdez. It's the name of the vessel is really all it is. It's a magnetic sticker, and we have a large map of the entire sound, and I put it where the vessel was and where it was going. So what I did is I set it up on the chart, and I cocked it at approximately 200.
How did you know where the vessel was?
I could see them on radar at that time. They were just slightly south of Rocky Point.
Do you have the ability to plot on the status board?
Yes, I do. If I
Would you describe how you would plot on the status board?
Well,
I don't understand.
Well, generally, as a rule, you don't plot on the status board. Okay. If I had to, I could, because it's just a large chart. You can plot on it if you have a mind to.
How large is this status board?
I would say it's roughly 6 to 7 feet tall by 8 feet wide.
It's still not clear to me how you would plot on an 8x7 chart. What tools would you use?
There's not a whole lot of tools you could use. What I'm saying, if you gave me a longitude and a latitude, I could go up to that chart and tell you where that was at.
And what happened next?
After Skip came in?
Yes.
I relayed what was going on. I said all the paperwork was up. I had two vessels inbound, and one was an hour out from Cape Hinchinbrook, and another one was approximately an hour behind the vessel, 2 hours out from Cape Hinchinbrook. Then I told him that the Exxon Valdez was outbound. They were going down through the ice, deviating across the lanes, and they would call him when they wound their way down through there. They would give him a call with an updated ETA and an updated ice report.
During our early interview, you made reference to the fact that vessels traveling through the Valdez Arm are, in a usual term, are eyeballed, and that anybody up there can look at the thing that is qualified and has been doing it for a while and tell you whether they're in or out of the lane. Is that a fair estimation, how you monitor the vessels?
I can do it. I believe I can do it. I don't know about anybody else, but I think that I could. You could go up there, and I could probably show you in a short period of time, and you could also do it. Anybody could.
Okay, so the Exxon Valdez had altered course to 200. You still had them on the radar. Is that correct?
Right.
And Mr. Blanford had arrived at the station?
No, not yet.
Well, could you please describe the interaction between you and Mr. Blanford prior to you being relieved from then on?
Okay, the vessel called me. I don't know, I can't remember exactly what time they called me, but it was prior to Mr. Blanford's arrival, and told me that they were going to 200 at 12 knots. I rogered that. Shortly thereafter, Mr. Blanford arrived. And I gave him the particulars of the watch, what was happening. I told him the tank missile Exxon Valdez was outbound. They were 200-12 knots. They'd call him within, when they got through the ice, with an ETA to Naked Island and an updated ice report. I also relayed to him that there were two inbound vessels, one hour out from Cape Hinchinbrook, one 2 hours out from Cape Hinchinbrook.
And what time was that?
Approximately between 23:30 and 23:45 that this went on.
Did Mr. Blanford have the opportunity to see the Exxon Valdez on the radar?
I don't believe he did. Just before he got there, I was when the vessel told me that it was going to 200 at 12 knots, I was on the 6 mile scale. I observed them to be, in my estimation, the western edge of the outbound traffic lane when they disembark the pilot. They sometimes swing over there. They provide a lee for the vessel provides a lee for the pilot whenever it can to make the disembarking as easy and safe as possible. So they were on the western edge when they dropped off the pilot, and they started coming down slowly in the northbound or the southbound lanes. And that time he said, we're going to go over to 200 at 12 knots. I saw them on my radar on the offset 6 mile scale until they were in the separation zone. At that time, the vessel started blinking on and off the screen, which means that I would get a couple of sweeps on the radar scope and I wouldn't see them for a couple of sweeps, and they'd be there for a couple of sweeps. I switched over to the 12 mile scale at that time, and for three or four sweeps I saw no vessel at all. At that time I switched back to the 6 mile scale because I still had approximately an inch and a half on that scale on my screen to see that vessel.
What radar unit did you switch to the 12-mile scale?
That was the slave radar unit.
The slave radar operates off the master radar, is that correct?
I believe that the master radar was on the 12-mile scale at the time.
Are you sure whether or not, are you sure of that?
No, I am not.
So you put the radar on the 12-mile scale and you were not able to pick up the Valdez at all?
No, I was not.
Can you estimate how far off the Valdez was? What was the range?
It was between Busby Island and Rocky Point, that area in between there. That's about a 5 mile area, I believe.
5 miles from Potato Point?
No, 5 miles between Rocky Point and Busby Island, somewhere in that vicinity.
How far is Rocky Point from Potato Point?
I'm not sure. 8 miles, 8.2, something like that.
Was the radar an offset?
Yes, it was.
So it was on the 12-mile scale in offset. What is the general?
It was on a 6-mile scale offset to 10 miles.
I thought you were just telling us that it was on the 12-mile scale.
I told you that I switched it over to the 12-mile scale and I saw the vessel. I did not see the vessel at all. So I switched it back to the 6-mile scale offset, and that's when I could still see the vessel a little bit. It was coming on and off, but it gave me a longer return. The radar scope may longer return. So even though it would go two sweeps without seeing the vessel, I had the target stretcher on. The target stretcher stretches your target out a little bit, makes you see it a little better. It would just hold there for a second, and that would give that sweep enough time to make another sweep. So I felt that I could see it better on a 6 mile scale. Obviously I could, because I couldn't see it on the 12 mile scale.
When a vessel transiting the Valdez Arm requests permission to leave a lane, are you actually granting permission, or are you just acknowledging the fact that they've already altered course?
Well, basically, I believe that we're acknowledging the fact. They do ask for permission to leave. If there was other vessels in the vicinity that would endanger them, then I just let them know about that, and they probably wouldn't.
Earlier you mentioned about the overlay that gave an outline of the traffic separation scheme. And then you mentioned that you vessels were not being picked up very well at 12 miles. How far out does the traffic separation scheme start?
How far out does it start?
How far out from Potato Point does this overlay show up on the screen?
Are we talking about the overlay, or are we talking about the traffic separation scheme?
The overlay that indicates a traffic separation scheme.
Okay, I would say it goes down approximately 14 miles.
Do watchstanders have permission, or do vessels, do they have to obtain permission from the VTC in order to deviate from the traffic separation scheme?
The vessel traffic manual says that they're supposed to call up and request permission, or tell us actually what their plans are.
Do you have to go to your immediate supervisor to obtain permission to let them do that?
No.
In your experience as a traffic controller, have you observed vessels leave the traffic separation scheme on a number of occasions?
Well, I don't understand the question.
Do vessels regularly leave the traffic separation scheme because of possibility of ice, or they detected ice in the arm?
Most of the time, they just deviate over into the northbound lane if there's no opposing traffic, depending on the ice. I didn't see the ice. I don't run the ship. In that respect, I couldn't really tell you that. They do depart the traffic separation scheme to go to Knoll's Head, Anchorage area. And if they're just making round turns because there's no berthing open, the Anchorage area is closed up, and sometimes they'll request permission to go outside the lanes.
When you were a traffic controller, you were a traffic controller in 1981, is that correct?
Yes.
Were there any statistics maintained at the MSO Valdez regarding the number of vessels that were forced to deviate from the traffic separation scheme?
Not that I know of.
So as far as you're concerned, the vessels were not recorded as leaving the traffic separation scheme during that time?
As far as I'm concerned, yes.
Over the number of years you've been at the vessel traffic controller, do you perceive the ice condition to have deteriorated over the years?
Yes.
Could you elaborate?
More ice. There seems to be more ice. Columbia Glacier appears to be calving a lot more than it has in previous years. And so there's more ice out there. The glaciers calve back, I don't know how many miles, but there's an awful lot more ice as far as I'm concerned.
A few moments ago, we talked about vessels receiving authorization to leave the traffic separation scheme. If you look in the vessel traffic manual, your ops manual, which is Exhibit 7 Alpha, page 22, paragraph 4.3.
Mr. Johnson?
One moment.
Oh, sorry.
This is live coverage from KSK Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network of the National Transportation Safety Board public hearing on the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. Richard Johnson, a marine accident investigator, is quizzing Gordon Taylor, who was on watch at the Coast Guard, in the shift just before the vessel ran aground. They're looking in the manual now to see what it says about whether vessels whether they're just simply notifying the controllers that they're deviating out of the lanes, or whether they actually have to get permission.
I'm looking at paragraph 4.33E. and it discusses vessels seeking permission to leave the traffic separation scheme. My question is, if you have a take a minute or so to read it, is that, does this indicate that the policy is that you would have to go to your commanding officer in order to have permission for vessels to leave the traffic separation scheme?
Now, where am I looking at on page 22 again?
Paragraph E is right at the top. The VTC may upon request.
Okay. What was your question?
The question is, after reading the instructions from the operations manual, which is signed by your commanding officer, would you say that you would still be able to allow vessels to leave the traffic separation scheme without notifying the CO in advance?
I would contact the OD, the officer on watch at the time.
Is this a policy that you were aware of prior to now?
Well, when it says here the VTC shall refer all requests to the commanding officer, I don't refer all requests to the commanding officer. I would refer the request to the OOD, which was the officer of the day, and he would, if he saw fit, would most likely refer it to the commanding officer.
Is the officer of the day what VTC qualified?
I don't know. I would assume that he was, but I do not know.
Is the OD on watch . Do you know the identities of the ODs? Is there a rotation, a watch rotation
of
ODs? You're familiar with the individuals?
Most of them.
Are you aware whether any of them are watch standard qualified?
It's not for me to say if they're watch qualified or not.
When I mean watch standard qualified, I'm referring to VTC watch standard qualified.
I would assume so. I've never seen any of them on watch. No, I would assume that they are qualified.
Were there any policy changes regarding the plotting of vessels in Valdez Arm in 1977?
I didn't hear the question.
What was the policy for plotting vessels in Valdez Arm in 1987?
What was the policy?
Yes. Were there any changes to the standing operating procedures for plotting vessels in the Valdez Arm?
So I started working there in 1987. At the time, from what I recall, the policy was not to plot them, actually plot them down through there, was to visually monitor them until they got up within a mile either side of the one-way traffic zone. That's my understanding.
I don't have any further questions.
Mr. Johnson, will you repeat your question and see if the witness has answered it.
I have no further questions. Is that what you...
That last question, you looked a little confused on the answer. Do you want to repeat your question?
I was wondering if the policy for plotting vessels in the Valdez Arm had changed since 1987, and he stated that he arrived at 1987, and the policy, as I interpreted him, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Taylor, is that you only plot vessels within the Narrows and that you monitor them visually in the vicinity of the Valdez Arm. Is that correct?
Right.
I don't have any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Dr. Berkey?
Mr. Taylor, I understand you would be classified as a civilian in the Coast Guard. Is that correct?
I don't consider myself a civilian in the Coast Guard, no. I consider myself an employee for the Department of Transportation. At least that's what my handy-dandy little ID card says.
Okay, but you would not be classified as a military personnel, would you?
No, sir.
Okay. Are you familiar with a practice of some outbound vessels cutting the corner of the arm using ice as an excuse or a rationale for doing that cutting?
No, I am not.
Did the Arco Juno follow a track line that would conform to that practice when it came in?
I did not see the Arco Juno down that far. When it came in, I don't believe they, if they were going to cut corners, it would be going outbound, I would think. But I guess they could cut them coming inbound, but I haven't seen it.
Okay. Are you... You've used the word to describe your position as a watch stander, I believe.
Yes.
Is that different from a classification of a vessel traffic controller?
Well, vessel traffic controller is really a poor word because we do not control traffic. We control the traffic in such that we only allow one vessel at a time through the one-way traffic zone. That would be control. Other than that, we don't control them.
Okay. Could we have the witness be given Exhibit 11 Bravo, please? And would you turn to, when you have that, to page 2 of Appendix A of that document, please?
Gordon Taylor from the Valdez Traffic Control Center monitors tanker traffic is now referring to some of the documents. He's being grilled by one of the members of the technical panel of the National Transportation Safety Board.
Page 2 of the Appendix A in that document. Okay. Do you have that, sir?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Would you look under the section entitled United States Coast Guard Category 1? The fourth item down lists a vessel traffic controller as a GS classification 2150. Do you fit that classification?
I believe so.
So you would then be classified, according to this document, which is the Department of Transportation's drug-free workplace document policy? Is that correct?
Say the question again, please.
I'm sorry. Would you then, you would be classified, according to that document, then as a vessel traffic controller?
Yes.
And I see no classification for a watchstander.
I don't either.
Does that mean that's not a recognized position within the Coast Guard?
No, I don't believe it does.
Okay.
You're saying that the Coast Guard doesn't recognize vessel watch standards?
Pardon me?
Is that what you're trying to... I don't understand what you're
questioning. Well, I'm just trying to assess what your classification is in terms of your government position, whether you're a controller or watch stander, or whether there is indeed a watch stander position.
I am a vessel watch stander at the MSO Valdez. Yes, I
am. Does it say that? Does it say that on your government classification, your personnel classification?
I'm not sure.
Does it classify you as a GS-2150?
Yes, I believe it does.
Okay, so we know you're classified as 2150. You would fall in this document, at least, as
right.
an individual that needs to be drug tested in the event of an accident, or possibly drug tested, right?
That's, well, the only thing I see here is a vessel traffic controller, GS-2150. I'll admit to that.
Okay, all right. We'll go from there.
Okay.
Thank you. In carrying out your position responsibility as a, I'm going to classify you as a vessel controller at the moment.
Okay.
According to that document, would you consider that position you hold as being important to the safe operation of vessels in and out of Valdez?
Yes.
Are you familiar with the Department of Transportation drug policy for civilian employees?
No, I don't know it verbatim.
Pardon me?
But I'm vaguely familiar with it.
What were you told about the reasons for undergoing testing for drugs?
I believe I was told that this is done in all of these accidents type stuff.
Post-accident testing?
Yes.
And when were you told that and by whom?
I can't really give you a specific time. I believe it was the evening of the 26th, I was called in. I didn't get a reason why I was called in, but I was called back to the station from my home. At what time I arrived, that's when I was told this. I would say probably 19:30 in that area. That's about what time I arrived, 20:00 on the 26th, I believe.
7:30 to 8
right.
o'clock p.m.
Right.
Uh-huh. And when did you then actually provide a sample, and to whom?
I provided it to a person who described himself as an Upjohn employee who was sent over here from South Carolina to procure a couple of samples from myself and the other watch stander. I believe I provided one between 2100 and 2200 that evening.
And were you provided results of that testing?
Yes, I was.
Were you also asked if you would be willing to release the results of the tests?
I was asked, yes, I was.
Did you agree to release those results?
Yes, I did.
In writing? Whom did you release, say you agreed to release those results?
To one of the Coast Guard personnel.
When was that?
That was a couple hours ago.
Were you asked previously by NTSB to release some results?
Yes, I was.
And what was your response to that?
No.
You are now prepared to release those results?
I said I was. Yes, I guess I am.
Do you want to provide those?
I don't have them with me. I can tell you what I received, a piece of paper approximately a week later from the Coast Guard saying 000 negative.
All negatives?
That's a roger.
And were those tested under the DOT program with DHHS guidelines? You don't know those?
No, I do not.
Okay.
I gave my sample and went about my way.
You indicated, if I may change the subject a little bit, indicated earlier that you got a pre-call from the Exxon Valdez. Do you know who that was from?
Yes, it was from the pilot. I talked only with the pilot until the pilot disembarked at Rocky Point.
Did you ever talk to the captain of the Valdez?
I believe I did now. At the time, I thought I was talking to the third mate, but listening to the third mate yesterday or the day before, whenever he gave his testimony, the voice didn't sound the same. The voice I heard was a gravelly, a deeper voice with sort of a drawl. I now think that it was the master I was speaking to.
So you're not really sure who
you
were?
No, I'm not. I still don't know. I went by what the papers said, and they told me I was talking to the third mate, so that's what I assumed.
Did you detect anything unusual about the voice that triggered
anything
for you?
No, I did not. Not a thing. He was talk slow, but he talked quite coherently.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Berg.
Just a quick question. You said you watched the Arco Juno depart the Narrows earlier
yes.
that evening. And you did paint her on your radar, at least for a time.
I didn't hear. I did what?
You did see the vessel on your radar,
yes,
at least for a time. Did you have the traffic separation scheme overlay on the radar at that time?
I did on through the Narrows, yes. I had that overlay. I didn't have the lower overlay down through the arm. I didn't have that arm on at the time. There's two overlays. There's an overlay through the Valdez Narrows, just the Narrows, and then there's an overlay which begins down on the Rocky Point vicinity going on down past Bly Reef South.
Okay, so did you observe the Arco Juno leaving where you figured the traffic lanes were?
Yes, I did. I saw it make its turn when they said they were going to cut over towards the Bly Reef buoy. I saw it make its turn towards Bly Reef, yeah. I saw that.
Did you see it long enough to see that it had actually crossed the northbound lane and left the TSS entirely?
I do not know if it left the TSS. They did not pass it on to me.
That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Gresh. Mr. Shire, will you introduce yourself and your title since you're the alternate for Mr. Howitt, and then ask questions if you have any?
Yes, my name is Lawrence D. Shire. I'm with Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Marine Manager, Valdez Terminal, alternate for William Howitt, and no questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. Captain Deppe.
Mr. Taylor, in the week following the grounding of the Exxon Valdez, did you ever put the radar on scale far enough away so you could observe the position of the Valdez?
Yes, I did.
Could you see it pretty clearly at that time?
You could see it, yes. It was sideways instead of just having the rear end of a laden vessel outbound. It was sideways, which gives me 1,000 feet of radar return, making it possible for me to see the vessel down there, yes.
Was it a pretty good return?
I could see it. I would say that's a pretty good return.
What percentage of the time could you see it all the time?
Yeah, most of the time we could see it, I'd say all the time. It got smaller and bigger, but there was always one dot, you know, that you could see there.
Okay. Yeah, you also mentioned earlier that, or I think you mentioned that you had the ability to punch up the traffic separation scheme on the radar and that could extend all the way down to Bly Reef. Is that what you said?
If you're talking about the lower lines that show the north inbound and outbound lanes, yes. That's
okay. And did you ever do that during that week the Valdez was aground?
I can't recall.
Did you ever take the occasion to see whether the Valdez was outside the traffic separation scheme by putting an overlay on the radar?
No, I did not. Okay.
Could you tell that it was outside the traffic lanes just by your experience with the radar and work in the center?
Well, I wasn't, the last time I saw the vessel on radar, it was what I perceived to be the separation zone. After that, I lost the vessel on radar, so therefore I did not see it go outside.
I'm talking about in the week after the vessel grounded.
Okay. Give me the question again.
Okay. Could you tell that the vessel was clearly outside the traffic lane at that point?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Since the Valdez went aground, what policy has the Vessel Traffic Center been following as opposed to previous to the Valdez grounding as far as plotting ships on the way out?
Okay, as far as plotting inbound and outbound, we plot them from the time they leave. That's with a visual plot and a paper plot plus a data log recorder on a six-minute plot until they reach the Valdez Narrows. At that time, we switch over to a three-minute plot until they're through the Narrows. At that time, we switch back to a six-minute plot. That's from, say, Potato Point all the way down until we lose them on the screen, which would be anywhere from 8 to 14 miles.
When you look at the radar screen, is the Exxon Valdez aground between that 8 and 14 mile area?
I believe it's 13.2 miles. Okay. And yes, it is aground. Yeah. It was aground.
You said that you had some trouble when you changed from the 6 mile scale to the 12 mile scale. Do you have any idea why you would have a problem when you change scales, being able to pick up the ship on one scale and not on another scale?
Well, actually, I don't know why. I just thought it was because the radars weren't working as well as they should have been at the time. That was my theory. It just didn't work, so I went back to the 6 mile scale.
I'm going to refer to Exhibit 7A just for my next couple of questions here. And let's see. Page 10. Paragraph 2.
1 minute, Captain.
Okay.
What's the page again?
You're listening to coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearing into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. Coverage is brought to you by KSK Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Paragraph 2.2.3 says watch routine.
Yes.
And it says one watch standard shall be assigned to the radar console at all times. This watch standard shall monitor the radar and maintain contact, identification, and plots, and conduct communications with vessels as prescribed by this manual. Is that how you operated during that night? Was there a watch standard at the console at all times?
Yes, there was.
Okay. And he never left the console?
Well, there's only two of us there. There's myself and there's a radioman. If I was out of the room for, say, 10 minutes, then he would keep an eye on things.
Okay. My next question is on page 19. And paragraph 4.1.1, where it's part function. And the last two sentences there says the VTC should recognize potential trouble spots and recommend against any practice which could result in danger of collision or grounding. In certain circumstances, recommendations will not be sufficient and will be necessary for the VTC to direct or prohibit vessel movements. Would you consider that with heavy ice and coming out of Columbia Glacier there, that would be a situation in which the VTC might want to recommend actions for vessels that are deviating from the lane?
No. What actions? I don't understand what actions you'd like me to recommend.
Well, if you saw a vessel that was about to go aground, you might recommend that they not that they change course.
Right, I would definitely do that.
Okay. Also, there was some talk yesterday that navigating through ice would be a hazard to navigation. There are some definitions here about hazardous circumstances. If you look, go down on that page 19 where it's paragraph D, 4.12D, there's a sentence there that says, the VTC has the authority to issue directions to any vessel in the VTS area during hazardous circumstances. Would you consider ice clogging the traffic lanes to be a hazardous circumstance?
Yes, I would.
Okay, that's all the questions I have. Thanks.
Commander Waldron. Mr. Colucciello.
Mr. Taylor, with respect to using the two radars in the master and the slave, can you call up the TSS overlay on either or both of those?
You can now, but at the time, no, you could not. You could only call it up on the slave, on indicator number 3.
And why couldn't you call it up on the master?
Basically because it wasn't programmed into the machine at that time.
Had it ever been programmed into the machine?
No, I do not know that, sir.
Does your ability to monitor or receive signals on the slave depend on the relative scale setting, range setting of the two?
Of the
master and the slave.
Okay. Yes, it does.
Could you explain that?
If I have the master on the master radar on say 12-mile scale, then I do not get a good 3-mile or 6-mile reading off of my slave. So if going through the narrows, we have to have it on 3-mile scale. I'll switch the master radar over to 6-mile, and that way I can switch the slave radar to 3-mile and have a good picture there, but still be able to see down farther on my master radar.
And when it comes to tracking in the arm, do you have a similar problem?
Yes, I do. If you've got the master radar on 3-mile scale and you turn your slave radar up to 6 or 12, it's not going to come in as well, if at all. Sometimes you won't even get a picture, you just get some spikes. Spikes are just mm-hmm. bright little lines.
Well, when you were tracking the Exxon Valdez, you said the master was on 6-mile scale? Or correct
when
me.
When I was tracking the Exxon Valdez through the narrows.
No, I meant after it left the narrows, was in the arm, and you were watching it, not tracking it, I guess, in your terminology, you were monitoring it.
Yes.
What scale was the master on?
For a time, it was on 6 as well as the slave. And I can't remember if that's the way I left it when I was relieved of the watch, or I had switched. I had the master on 12 and the slave on 6. I can't remember that. I believe that they were both on 6-mile scale, but I'm not sure.
Well, when you said that you lost it, did you lose it on the master or did you lose it on the slave?
I lost it on the slave.
Well, did that mean that, could that have been because there was a difference in scale settings between the two that gave you a less reception on the slave?
I don't believe so. I don't believe that was a problem because, like I say, if I switch it over, most of the time it'll spike, telling you that you don't have a picture. And then at that time, I'll look over at my master and reach over and click it up or down a scale, and that'll bring my video back.
Mm-hmm. Would this problem be alleviated if you had the logger, and assuming that you wanted to log these and track them that way, put the logger onto the master instead of onto the slave?
No. It would help, but you still have the same problem with you losing your picture when you switched up from the 3 to the 12 or 3 to the 6, and when the other one is in a different rain setting. What they've done is given them both their own MTR, which means that they're both separate. They're separate units now, so we don't have that problem.
Okay, so since the accident, you're saying that you now have loggers on the master and a separate logger on the slave?
We don't have a logger on the master yet, but the master isn't master anymore, is what I'm trying to tell you, that there is no master now.
How do you designate them now?
They each have their own power source out there. Each one is its own. There's still 1, 2, and 3, but one's not a master anymore.
I see. So that now you can take number 1 and put it on its own antenna, and number 2 on its own antenna?
Yes.
Now, why wasn't this possible before?
I do not know.
All right. You mentioned something about the OD. Is the OD the supervisor of the watch?
Yes, he is. And supervisor of the entire station for the day, not only the watch.
Well, on that night of the accident, where was the OD?
I don't know if he was in the building or at home. I hadn't seen him for an hour or two.
And so when you have to report something to the OD, well, let me ask you this. Have you had occasion to report things to the OD?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
Well, okay. I didn't know you didn't communicate with the OD that night then.
Not that I recall. Mm-hmm.
If you did have a problem in the center, would you call someone else or would you call him?
I would call the OD or call the duty ET. If the gear drops off a line or something like that, we have a power failure, then I would call the duty. I'd call both of them, actually. Usually I call the OD first, and he'll most likely tell me to call.
But
the
you
OD
consider
first.
The OD the supervisor of the watch, or is there no supervisor
he's
of the watch?
Supervisor of the
he's their supervisor of the station. He has overall responsibility. What I'm trying to establish is, is there someone who supervises your activity or the activity of the NVTC?
That would be the OD.
Pardon?
That would be the OD.
How often does he come into the VTC?
Usually he's close by. He goes home at night between 10 and 12, depending on what's going on around.
So he has the OD for 24 hours, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So he's there during the day?
He's in his office, which would be right across the hall.
But then he goes home at night, so he's in effect your supervisor at night while he's home. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Does he ever call to check to find out what's going on?
Yes, he does.
Well, what would the calls be like?
The call would be like, hi, this is the OD. Is anything going on? How are things? And at that time, I'll say everything's smooth or we're in deep trouble, one of the two. So far, everything's been smooth.
Did he call that evening while you were on watch?
Not that I remember. He was there for most of the evening, and then he departed. I don't know exactly what. I don't even know if he departed. I just know that he wasn't in the traffic center when I got relieved.
So when he goes home, he doesn't call up to VTC and say, look, if you need me, I'll be home. Does he call you?
He doesn't really call the VTC. He'll call the radio side. He usually always has a radio or a beeper with him at all times. And we can always call him up on the radio at a moment's notice.
But to the extent that there's supervision of VTC and the extent that someone is looking at what the work you're doing and how you're doing it and looking at the quality of the work, is there someone who fits this role?
Not standing right over your shoulder, no. There are people that check the logs, what you've written down, that make sure that you've done your plotting of the vessels and stuff like that. They do check on you, yes.
And the time between the check and the time that the event occurred, how close are they? I mean, is this done historically in the way of checking your paperwork?
You mean to come in while I'm at work and check my paperwork?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking?
Or checking what you're doing at the scope?
Yes, they come in from time to time, the ODs do, and see how things are going, check what we're doing.
I think you said that. Did you answer whether or not you know that they are qualified as controllers?
I do not know if they're qualified as controllers. I assume that they are qualified as controllers. But no, I mean, I did not ask them, no.
See, if you have questions about your work and what you're supposed to do, and who do you go to?
Well, if I can't get it out of the operations manual or the VTC manual, then I would ask the chief or the first class or the lieutenant or the XO or the CO, depending on who comes in at the time.
Is the chief then your next in line to give you guidance and to give you set quality standards?
I believe one of the first class petty officers are. But they answer directly. No, excuse me, directly to the chief.
I see, but it's, you say you believe it's not very clear in your mind who your direct supervisor is.
From what I understand, my direct supervisor is the commanding officer.
Direct supervisor is your commanding officer.
Well, is the guy that's in charge of me, but he's got lots of other things to do besides look over my shoulder. So I'm sure that he delegates his work down through the channels there.
Who makes the evaluation of your work, your performance?
I believe that's either one of the first class or the chief, or one of the.
Are you certain now, or you believe? You say
I believe, right? I believe that.
Did they ever talk to you? Did either one of them talk to you about your work and whether you're doing better or you need to improve or you're doing great?
Okay, we have a survey done on us every 6 months. That's done by the first class and the chief and whoever else in between. I see a copy of it, and the captain sees a copy of it and signs it as well as I.
Do these evaluations deal with your performance on the job?
Yes, they do.
They do? All right. I have no more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Am I live? On average, Mr. Taylor, about how many vessels are likely to traverse in and out, or either in or out, on a typical 8-hour watch?
On a typical 8-hour watch, I really couldn't give you an average for that. I could give you the averages they come up with is like 2.35 tankers per day. Okay. is the average that I was told.
So I suppose it's conceivable that you might either have one or perhaps no traverse during your watch.
Yes, sir. I could have upwards of actually 10 or 12 vessels, including ferries and tugs and tank vessels, during the watch, or I could have none.
Right. And again, I'm looking for average or typical. Once you encounter a traverse in or out, what would you guess is an average time that you are attending to that particular traverse?
Approximately 9 hours. So actually, for my entire watch, usually if a vessel checks in 3 hours out from Cape Hinchinbrook, and it's usually a 5 to 6 hour trip from Cape Hinchinbrook to the berth, I am in contact with that vessel for the entire time.
And what's the maximum number of vessels that you can recall you have been tracking at any one time?
I couldn't give you an exact number, but I could say probably six or eight at one time.
Under that kind of a, let's call it a maximum workload situation, how many times or what percentage of the time are you transmitting on the radio to him, or do you not do any of that?
I do talk on the radio to the tank vessels and the participating vessels. Mm-hmm. They call me up. I talk to them and let them know where everybody's at, what's happening throughout the sound. And usually they want to know where the tank vessels are so they can stay out of their way.
Would you characterize that six or eight per watch then a heavy workload?
Yes.
Is it a busy and taxing day?
That would be busy.
Mm-hmm. Now I'd like to contrast the before and after the accident. I believe you said that your plotting on 3-minute or 6-minute intervals since the accident. Is that in the something to continue in the foreseeable future indefinitely?
Yes, sir. I believe so.
How has that affected your workload?
It makes it a lot tougher for one person. If you've got just a couple of tankers, then it's quite easy. But if we've got 6 or 7 that you have to keep, then you're
hopping. That's precisely what I was leading to, is if you have 6 or 8, can you, as one controller, a watchstander, manage that workload?
I would say yes, but you got to be on your toes.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Mr. Taylor, just a few. You said earlier on March 23rd that there was a vessel that was going outbound, and you did receive some ICE reports from that vessel. That's correct?
Yes.
And I think you also said that that outbound vessel had to exit the outbound lanes. Did it ever get into the inbound lanes or exit the inbound lanes?
It went from the outbound lanes, southbound lanes, over across the separation zone into the inbound lanes.
Did it ever go outside of the northbound?
Not that I recall. I believe I can't recite it verbatim, but I believe they called me up and said that there was a 9/10 of a mile area that they get through there in the northbound lanes. They could scoot down through there.
When a vessel calls you, or the master or whomever calls you, and I don't know if they request, we've used several words today, request or you approve. Anyway, they alert you that they may have to do this for good reason. Does that make you any more aware to make sure that you track, monitor the vessel's heading or course?
If I can, yes, I do.
If you can?
If I can, yeah, it does ring a bell, you know, that they're doing something out of the ordinary.
Tell me why you could not.
I couldn't see them on the radar.
That would be, okay, that would be the reason that you can't
do
that.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Have you ever, and I think in response to a question from Captain Deppy, he was talking about the Prince William Sound VTC manual, and I think he found a couple places in there where it says, in essence, you're required to do a few things if you perceive a dangerous situation. And I may have characterized that incorrectly, but I think it's close. Have you ever had to do that? Have you ever had to tell a vessel to change course or to move out of the way, or has that ever occurred to you when you've been on watch?
Not that I recall, sir.
Just one other question. In response to Dr. Berkey, I think you said that initially when the safety board asked about your test results, you denied giving them to us. Is that true?
Giving them to us? Who's us?
The NTSB.
I didn't give them to you, no.
Okay. Can you, maybe I misinterpreted what Dr. Berkey said. Let me ask, did you not just say that 2 or 3 hours ago you told the Coast Guard something? What did you tell the Coast Guard 2 or 3 hours ago?
I just signed a piece of paper saying that they could tell the results of my test at this hearing. That's what the way I understood it.
Okay, you just did that 2 or 3 hours ago?
Yeah, because it was sent to me via a fax machine, and the person whom I was supposed to deliver it to was here. So instead of putting it in the mail, I hand carried it up here and saw the person just before.
Okay, so the Coast Guard asked you if you would be willing to release the results?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. You're excused, Mr. Taylor. Let's take a 10-minute break. We will be back at 3:45, and we will start at 3:45. Mr. Blanford will be our next witness.
Mr. Blanford would be the person who relieved the person we've just heard, Gordon Taylor, a vessel traffic controller who called himself a watchstander, a civilian working with the Coast Guard who was on duty the night the Exxon Valdez went aground on Bly Reef and spilled 11 million plus gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound. Good afternoon. I'm Steve Heimel, and you're listening to live coverage of the hearing on the wreck of the Exxon Valdez with the National Transportation Safety Board at the Captain Cook Hotel in downtown Anchorage. To briefly recap what's going on, this morning we heard from the first mate of the vessel, and from then on we've been talking to Coast Guard personnel and finding out how they approach their job. A good deal was made of authority questions this afternoon, talking to Mr. Taylor about what he felt, what authority he felt he had, who was in charge of him. It was disclosed that it's right in the rule book that if a vessel, if a tanker goes out of the traffic separation zone, you're supposed to check with your supervisor, and that wasn't done. In fact, under examination by Dickinson, Mr. Taylor said that he never felt, he never has ordered a vessel to do anything. So there's an authority question there. There's some discussion of the workload, of what time watches are stood, of the ice, and how much the ice seems to get in the way of tankers. The ice is picking up. Sometimes they do have to leave the separation zone, not that frequently. And a great deal of discussion about the critical point of how far can they see on the radar. Taylor said that once the vessel had gone aground after midnight when he was off of watch, it was a good target on the radar, but at times before that, as it deviated from the separation zone to allegedly avoid the ice, he could not pick it up on the radar. He had to change the range in order to bring it in on the radar. Sometimes it would be there, sometimes it wouldn't. The radar characteristics would change depending on the weather. And the kind of target presented. It was very hard to see ice on there. One issue that hasn't been brought up much yet is the question of the kind of radar they were using and whether the radar they had before then was actually superior.